Good afternoon and welcome to today's internet webcast, Bioavailability of Organic Compounds, Methods and Case Studies. The second of the Bioavailability, Metals, Organics, and Use at Hazardous Waste Sites Risk E-Learning Seminar Series sponsored by the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences Superfund Basic Research Program. I am Justin Crane with the Superfund Basic Research Program, and I will be the technical moderator for today's session. We will get started in a few moments. While we wait for others to log on, I would like to cover a few housekeeping items. When you registered, you were directed to the seminar's specific URL, which is the front page of today's seminar. The front page of the webcast contains a short abstract of today's session. We have also included pictures and short bio sketches of the presenters. Please note the presenters' email addresses are hot-linked on that page in case you have any questions after today's presentation. For those of you joining us via the phone lines, we request that you put your phone on mute for the seminar. We will have question and answer sessions, at which point you are welcome to take your phone off mute and ask a question. We ask that the phone line participants hold their questions until the question and answer session. If you do not have a mute button on your phone, we ask that you take a moment right now to hit *6 to place your phone on mute. When we get to the question and answer period, you can hit *6 to unmute your phone. This will greatly reduce background noises that can disrupt the quality of the audio transmission. Also, please do not put us on hold. Many organizations have hold music or advertisements that can be very disruptive to the call. Again, keep us on mute. Do not put us on hold. By now, those of you participating via the phone line should have the presentation open and should be on slide 1. All those participating via the internet should have clicked on the Go To Session icon near the bottom of the page and should be on slide 1 of the presentation. The main page contains the slides, above which you will find navigation icons. Internet participants may submit questions by using the question mark icon you see above the slide. You need not wait until the QA period to submit your questions. In fact, we encourage you to submit in advance of the question-answer session. Also, if you experience technical difficulties with the audio stream, you may use the question mark icon to alert us to the technical difficulties you are encountering. Please include a telephone number where you can be reached, and we will try to help you troubleshoot your problem. The presenters will be announcing the number of the slides to which they are moving. You may advance to the next slide using the single right arrow located above the slide or by clicking on the appropriate slide number in the left-hand frame. As stated earlier, we will have question and answer sessions. At the end of the presentation, we will walk you through our links page where we have assembled resources directly applicable to today's topic. This will stay with the seminar indefinitely so you can access it after the presentation. We typically place the seminar in an archive with a soundtrack, so in the near future, you'll be able to access the slides and hear the presentation as it was given today. Associated with the links page is an online feedback form. We ask that you consider filling out the online feedback form. We do look at your comments and we continue to try to improve the content and delivery mechanisms. Once more, I would like to remind phone participants to put your phones on mute. If you do not have a mute button on your phone, hit *6 now, and again, do not put us on hold. With that, we are ready to start the session. Once again, welcome to the Risk E-Learning, a web seminar series sponsored by the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences Superfund Basic Research Program in collaboration with the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. Today's session, Bioavailability of Organic Compounds, Methods and Case Studies, is the second of 3 sessions in the Bioavailability, Metals, Organics, and Use at Hazardous Waste Sites Risk E-Learning Web Seminar Series. Today's presenters are Dr. Ed Neuhauser and Dr. Danny Reibel. The following session, Use of Bioavailability Information at Hazardous Waste Sites, will air June 18th. It will feature Mike Berenger and Mark Mataloni. Once again, I would like to remind the phone participants to put your phone on mute. If you do not have a mute button, you can press *6 now to mute your phone, and *6 again later if you would like to ask a question. At this time, I would like to introduce our moderator, Dr. Carl Gustafson, Contaminated Sediment Liaison to U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, U.S. Army Engineer Research and Development Center. Carl?
Thanks for the introduction, Justin, and to the organizers of the seminar for the chance to be involved today, and of course, all the attendees that are participating by phone today. From my perspective, I greatly appreciate that the Superfund Basic Research Program has chosen to focus on bioavailability in the seminar series, particularly in regard to organic contaminants in sediments. It's really a topic where the field has come a long, long way in its understanding over the years, but at the same time, we have a long way to go. There's always going to be new wrinkles. And complexities that are going to continue to challenge our understanding on forcehead.
Carl, could I cut in for just a minute?
Sure, of course.
This is Justin again. It sounds like there are a few people online who still have not put their phone on mute, and it's very disruptive. If you don't have a mute button, if you could just press *6 now, that would greatly reduce the background noise. Thank you. Go ahead, Carl.
Yeah, I thought that was a bit early for questions, but thanks for cutting in, Justin. I was just talking about how there are always going to continue to be wrinkles and complexities in our understanding of bioavailability. And one of the things that's certainly clear is that the policy and the standard practice across the nation really hasn't even kept up with the science and that understanding that has been evolving of bioavailability and its effects to organisms. As we think about the influence of bioavailability at the multitude of contaminated sites that we have across the nation, we're still asking and we're still answering similar questions about, how do we measure bioavailability? Do we model it instead? What do we measure it with? And what parameters are we going to need to collect to do some modeling? If we do lab work or field work as a resident, laboratory or caged organisms, are we going to look at tissue concentrations or biomarkers? This range of questions, and of course, we also are thinking at the same time how similar or different are these answers at our various sites. So, the bottom line is that these are not easy, but they're important. They're essential questions. And, of course, that's where the research comes in. And we really have the pleasure today of hearing from two researchers that have been on the cutting edge of this field in evaluating the influence of bioavailability on the effects from contaminated sediments. The first half of today's seminar is going to be presented by Dr. Edward Neuhauser. He's a principal environmental engineer at the National Grid. His principal area of work is the remediation at manufactured gas plant sites. His recent research efforts focused on understanding the bioavailability of pH in sediments. He's part of a group of researchers that has produced a lot of really well-received and important work defining the components, the characteristics of sediments that really matter for bioavailability and influence the endpoints that really matter, the toxicity of organisms. The first talk is going to be determining true pH bioavailability in sediments using solid phase microextraction. I want to welcome you, Dr. Neuhauser.
Thank you. Can I go ahead and start the first talk?
Yes, please.
Okay. Well, thanks, Carl. If we would go to the second slide on your program. The goal of the whole program is to develop a chemical screening tool that predicts pH bioavailability in sediments and soils. And I think based on the chemistry you hear about today, this should work in soils as well as sediments. On the next slide, slide 3. Traditionally, when we've looked at sediment screening criteria, we've used some earlier work that looked at total PAHs using the EPA 16, which are the parent non-alkylated PAHs, and we've all seen things like threshold effect concentrations, probable effects concentrations, and these are numbers that are gotten from studies that give us an indication for where we should expect toxicity and where we should not be expecting toxicity. So if we look at slide number 4, we can see that what this gives us is an area of uncertainty between 1.6 and 22.8 milligrams per kilogram of PAHs. But we should also expect then that every time we have 22.8 milligrams per kilogram of PAHs, we should expect to see these sediments to be toxic. And the problem that's happened in my work is that we don't see that very often. We commonly see sediment concentrations going up to 1,500 to 1,700 with no toxicity at all. in slide number 5, what we've done is work with a group of people under the Sediment Contaminant Bioavailability Alliance. That's SCUBA you'll hear about later. And one of the people there is Steve Hawthorne at the University of North Dakota, who's a very good chemist, who has developed a method to use solid phase microextraction and apply it to our sediment sampling.
Sorry, I made a mistake.
Okay, this method that Steve has developed allows us to get a SPEME measurement in terms of the actual pHs that are in the sediments that are actually available to the organisms living in the top 6 inches of the sediments. If we go to slide number 6, one of the things that I want to emphasize is that as part of implementing this work almost 10 years ago, we recognized that there was a great deal of very good work done by the EPA in this area, and what we're really doing is just adding an enhancement to that existing work, and we're building on that work to get what we feel is maybe a little bit better method of being able to measure actual bioavailability. If we go to slide number 7, what we can see is that there was a series of KOCs measured by the EPA. But what we also did was took a large number of our sediments, and Steve Hawthorne went out and measured the KOCs in those, and we found them to be considerably higher, meaning that the pHs that we found in our sediments were bound much more tightly to the sediments than the EPA would have predicted using their KOC values. If we go to slide number 8, the reason that we think that that is happening is the presence of different types of carbon in the sediments. And what we have in our sediments is a lot of anthropogenic carbon because we're in areas where there's a great deal of man's influence. And as these manufactured gas plant sites that I work on, there was a lot of coal there. So there's a lot of influence of small bits of coal in the sediments, and we're seeing the contribution to those. And those bits of anthropogenic carbon are binding the pHs much, much tighter than would have been predicted if you just used natural organic matter, the carbon in natural organic matter. If we go to slide number 9, looking at our toxicity and calculating toxicity in terms of TUs, what we found was that the vast majority of the toxicity occurs from the 2, 3, and 4 ring pHs. A little bit of a surprise, very little contribution from the 5 and 6 ring pHs to toxicity. Also, what we saw here was that the carcinogenicity, the carcinogenic pHs, which are the ones that are actually circled in red, being of much higher molecular weight, also seemed to contribute, in this case, to very, very little toxicity. If we go to slide number 10, and we look at the amount of TUs and what different components are coming from, what we see is that the vast majority of the TUs, the toxicity from the TUs, is actually coming from the alkylated pHs. Not something that we were able to measure when we just look at the EPA 16 pHs. So there's a big contribution of the alkylated pHs to sediment toxicity. If we look at slide number 11, I mentioned this Sediment Contaminant Bioavailability Alliance. It's a group of industries and utilities that are interested in trying to figure out what's really going on out there in terms of actual bioavailability of pHs in sediments.
The internet's not open on your computer.
So one of the things that we did was we've gone to 18 different sites in the eastern part of the United States, and we've actually done a lot of sampling at these sites.
That's something I've noticed.
And what I'm going to do is present you the summary of, I'm going to highlight one site as a summary from one site, and then a summary of all those sites together to give you an idea of what we see actually happening in terms of true bioavailability.
Oh, you can't open Lotus Notes.
If we could go to slide number 12, please. This is a National Grid site on the Hudson River in Hudson, New York. And what you see are areas where there is some toxicity. Those are the red dots, and areas where it's not very toxic. And this is toxicity to Hyella azteca, which is we use an EPA standardized test to measure sediment toxicity. And if you look inside and see there's an embayment there along the shore where you see three green dots and two red, that embayment now has been completely dredged out and filled in. So the areas of toxicity will be the four red dots that are outside of that embayment. If we go to slide number 13, if we look at those, the values that we get for those sites in terms of what are toxic and what are non-toxic in the TUs, what we see at that site is that every time we measure less than 20 TUs, the sediments are non-toxic. Every time we measure greater than 35 TUs, when we test those sediments with Hyal Azteca, they're toxic. So we have a clear differentiation between the toxic and the non-toxic sediments. If we look at that on the next slide, number 14, that gives us the areas of concern that where if we're greater than 35 TUs for this site, you see the red areas on the right-handed side where we sampled. That gives us a small area where we really have to focus on and concentrate on. If we look at the left-hand side of that slide, if we had used the older method, the older way of looking at it, using just the parent pH 16, we would have had a much, much bigger area, which we would have had to have been potentially concerned with. So we feel this gives us a much better way of concentrating and focusing in for where we have to be in terms of where the toxicity really is taking place at these sites. If we go to the next slide, 15, we took all of the results. We took 178 sediment samples here, and we plotted them out in terms of total pH 16 and actual toxicity that we got. And you can see the green, the yellow, and the red zones. And what we see is there's really not a very good relationship. We're not able to predict with measuring just total pH 16s alone. We're not able to get a very good idea of what's toxic and what's non-toxic. So that doesn't appear to work very well for us at all. If we go to the next slide, 16.
Slide 16.
And we look at how does the actual concentration that we're measuring in terms of TUs compare to actual toxicity to our organisms? What we're seeing is if we're greater than 40 TUs, we're always toxic. And generally, if we're less than 5 TUs, we appear most of the time to be non-toxic. We do have this range in between of 5 and 40 TUs where we actually think that that's an area where we may want to do toxicity testing to be able to tell, because half of the samples in there are toxic and half of the samples are non-toxic. If we go to the next slide, 17, so we took our data that we had and we compared it to some of the standards and tried to get a handle on our ability to predict toxicity and to predict non-toxicity. Basically what we're saying is if we're less than 5 TUs, we are able to correctly predict non-toxicity 97% of the time. And if we're greater than 40 TUs, 100% of the time, those have shown out to be toxic. So we think this gives us a much better tool than the three examples listed above of the 1.6, the 22.8, and the EPA 1 TU unit, which was initially suggested as toxicity. So we have a handle now that we, another way of looking at this using the SPEME TUs. What we're suggesting is that this method of looking at PAHs is merely something that goes into the existing EPA model, and instead of measuring EPA 16, we simply measure the SPEME pore water and then follow through on this diagram. So if we get a SPEME TU 34 of greater than 5, we want to test that. If it's toxic to the organisms, that would be something we'd have to look at. But if it's less than 5, it's non-toxic, something probably we don't have to worry about. Another way of looking at this is to look at it on slide number 19 and to think of this as a traffic light approach. If we're in the green of less than 5 TUs, we're probably non-toxic and we're not going to, biological testing will not be required. If we're in the red zone of 40 TUs, that sediment is definitely probably toxic. You probably don't have to do biological testing, although you could confirm it. If you're between 5 and 40, we would suggest that this is when you want to conduct some type of biological testing. Hyella certainly is not the only thing that we can do. A couple of other things that we're doing as part of this program is that this SPEME method is being standardized by Steve Hawthorne with the ASTM, and that will then be standard, then be accepted by EPA. That's going to take us probably another 2 years to get that through. We are also having this technology presented and worked with. We worked with ITRC now for 2 years, so they're also a part of this, and the regulators there are learning about this and figuring out how they can apply it. We are applying it to some of our own sites at National Grid here in New York, working with our New York State DEC. We also listed at the supporting documentation for this seminar, we do list a web site for the SCUBA, scubaweb.com. That has a list of all our publications. So if anyone wants to get more information on that, they can look at that, and the specific peer-reviewed publications are on there. One other minor thing is we have done a lot of testing also with chironomids, and we've also gone out and done a lot of testing where we've actually done benthic sampling as well. And we find generally that Hyella is number one, much more sensitive than chironomids in terms of laboratory testing. We also find that in the field, the benthic macroinvertebrates are even, we find large numbers of them, even in many of the toxic locations. They're amazingly tough, particularly the tubophysids. We haven't actually found a site where we haven't found a tubophysid yet. So that's just a supporting to that. At this time, I think I'll be glad to take questions if there's any.
Thank you, Dr. Neuhauser. Just a second before we take questions, I'd like to remind people that we can hear a few people still talking in the background. It seems like their phone is not on mute. If you don't have a mute button, you can use *6 to mute your phone. So with that, we'll take a few minutes to have a question-answer session. If you have a question you would like to ask, please press or take your phone off mute or press *6 once again. State your name, your organization, and ask your question.
I have one. Can you hear me?
In 20 minutes.
Go right ahead.
This is Fred Fender, University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Ed, Ed, the range of 5 to 40 that you've identified, how different might that range be at a different site?
We're generally finding that that's a pretty good approximation. We've done this at, as I mentioned, I believe 18 different sites. It may at a specific site go, you know, down to 35. 5 seems to be pretty close to the bottom. You could easily do it at 1. If you said, well, I'm everything greater than 1 TU, I want to do biological testing, you could do that. That would work out fine.
Is that an endpoint that the regulator is likely to buy? I mean, you get 178 samples that say this is the range for your site. If we're doing this in Chesapeake Bay, are we likely to?
I would hold out with tick two.
By the way, I think your problem is not people with phones on mute. I think it's people who have speakers, have microphones on their computers for the internet, and they have their microphones turned on.
Maybe that's what it means.
So they need to turn them off. That was my question, Ed, in terms of how difficult is regulatory acceptance of this idea going to be?
Fred, we've done so far, we've done 3 marine sites. We've gotten fairly similar results. I can say that the regulators, when we work with them, they recognize that the methods that are out there now are not as good as they could be, and they're very willing to look at this, and particularly in our case here in New York State on a site-by-site basis, consider what we're getting.
You may have relatively informed regulators in New York.
Well, I think we probably do.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay.
Could I ask a question, Steve Claw from Haley Aldrich?
Right.
Dr. Neuhauser, when you look at the different, the green or the yellow or the red,
right,
and you pull up your benthic grabs, are there people looking at the individual biota and classifying them as to whether they might be pollution tolerant?
Yes, we actually are in the process of writing a paper. We have 56 locations where we actually did all three things on the sediment samples. We did the chemical testing, we did the laboratory testing, and we did the benthic measurements. And we're actually in the process of getting that manuscript finalized.
Great.
So you will see, and I can tell you that what we found is that the benthic communities are incredibly robust. And I've not had a sediment site, even though I've practically gone in some extremely tar areas where tarry sediments, where I didn't get something.
Now, where's the mute button?
So, in other words, Mother Nature's always surprised you.
Mother Nature is very tough.
Hi, this is Mindy Pensack, EPA Region 2.
Yes.
When you're defining toxicity, you're using the sediment toxicity test. Have you ever used early life stage test or look at photosensitivity? So different endpoints rather than the standard sediment toxicity test?
No. I can tell you that when we've analyzed our data for Hyella, for growth, the effects on growth, seeking that would be a sublethal effect, we're not seeing anything, but we haven't done anything in terms of phototoxicity.
A 28-day test or a 42-day test?
28-day test. Not the 42. The problem with the 42-day test is that the laboratories have a very hard time keeping everything alive that long. And
right, I understand that.
And they actually tell us they don't recommend the use of that test because you end up spending a lot of money and your controls end up dying.
Right, I'm just concerned that the Hyalilla might not be the most sensitive endpoint, even though you are looking at a chronic endpoint, and that if I kind of wonder if you looked at different endpoints, would it still fall out the same way with the toxicity unit?
I can tell you that we one of the reasons of selecting Hyalilla was that based on that EPA, that 93 EPA document, it is one of the more sensitive organisms, so it's down there quite low. We've also found that it's quite a bit more sensitive than chironomids, but I don't have any more data than that to tell you about. No photos. Okay.
Thanks, Ed. We've got quite a few questions on the simulcast lines as well, so let me start by reading one of those. This question is from Mary Logan, US EPA Region 5 in Chicago. She says, on slide 16, how do they account for the toxic samples lower than 5 TUs? And were there other contaminants or site geochemistry that can account?
Yes, I'm very glad she brought that up. Those two dots that you see there on slide 16, where there are those two red dots that they're about 0.1 TUs, and also some of the other ones that are slightly above one. What we have noticed with those is that those happen to be sediment samples with extremely low amounts of organic matter. And what we think is happening there is that even though there's some organic matter added to this test, that the organisms that we test are actually living off some of the organic matter in the natural sample. And I've actually proposed to my group that we conduct the test on some of those sediment samples and by feeding those organisms show that the test is not due to toxicity, but rather the test is due to the failure of the organisms is due to lack of food. That's what we think is happening there. But we will confirm that with laboratory studies.
Thank you. Let's take another question from the simulcast listeners. I'm not going to pronounce this name correctly, but I will give it a shot. This is from Vijaya Mailavarupa Rapu from CH2M Hill in Orlando, Florida. Her question is, have you tested asphalt material from road or parking lot pavements?
No, we have not.
Okay. Simulcast listeners, this is from Ursula McKnight, University of Tübingen in Germany. She says, how important is the assumption of equilibrium partitioning when estimating the PAH concentration?
We've conducted some laboratory experiments to see how rapidly our sediment samples would come into equilibrium with the pore water, and we find that it's approximately 24 hours we get very good equilibrium.
Okay, thank you. Let's go back to the phone lines. If you are on the phone and you have a question to ask, please take your phone off mute, state your name and organization, and ask your question.
Yes, I have a question. My name is Ken Finkelstein with NOAA, and I was looking back at one of the slides. I think it was the next one, 17, and you showed greater than one SPME, about a 45% chance of toxicity. Is that correct?
That's a correctly predicting toxicity, right.
Okay, well, you know, what I'm thinking is, you know, 45% is almost 50%.
It's a toss-up, yeah.
Yeah, so why would you not want to do biological testing around the 1, if not even less than 1, even down to 30 or 25% chance of toxicity? It seems to me that...
You could take that approach and do that. If you wanted to be ultra-cautious, that's the ability, remember, to predict toxicity.
I don't think it's ultra-cautious at all. I mean, you know, you could always go to the old baseball analogy, the 300-hitter gets up at the bottom of the ninth, that's 30%. And you're feeling pretty good about yourself.
Yes, but you're right. You could do that.
Okay.
We'll stay with the phone lines. If you have a question, please take your phone off mute, state your name and organization, and ask your question.
Hi there. My name is Susan Rowan from Environment Canada in Ottawa. And I was just wondering if you could please clarify how the toxic unit 34, the TU-34, is calculated, please.
I don't want to go into that. That's in the EPA document that's cited there on that slide. There's a 1993 EPA document, and they go into all the descriptions of the toxic units.
Let's stay with the phone lines. If you have a question, take your phone off mute, state your name, organization, and ask your question.
Yes, hello. This is a question from EPA Region 5. My question is, do you intend to apply this methodology for microbioavailability also?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand the question.
Do you intend to apply this methodology for methyl bioavailability as well?
Metal bioavailability would be a little different. And we haven't looked at it. It probably will work with PCBs because they're hydrophobic organics, but metals would behave a little differently. And I don't have any data or any information about metals.
This is Brett Thomas with EPA Region 4.
Okay.
Just a question about some people had alluded to it before where they were asking about looking at the benthic community,
yes.
In addition to the Hialeah toxicity,
yes,
and where you said you're pulling up samples and finding the benthic stuff there, I guess a question or suggestion would be to make use of some of the quantitative macrobenthic indices. You know what I mean?
Yes, we actually have done 5 of those,
and they're seem to be coming up pretty good.
They actually correlate very well.
Your this study that you're looking at is the Hudson, which is going to be, you know, obviously a pretty large river system.
Right.
Have you guys looked at other types? I know you looked at some marine, smaller streams and that type of thing.
Most of the water bodies that we look at are things like the Hudson and the Mohawk. So you're not getting up into sampling the kinds of things like in trout streams and stuff. We don't get into those. Are you familiar with the New York tolerance score?
No, I'm not.
Okay, that looks at organisms from 1 to 10, 1 being things that live in a trout stream, 10 being tubifissids.
Right.
And it takes all the benthics and classifies them that way. We predominantly end up, because of the waterways we're dealing with, looking at organisms that are in the 7, 8s, and 9s.
Yeah, okay.
We don't get into the types of situations where you would actually have trout streams.
Right. All right, thanks.
Okay, welcome.
Hi, this is Shelton Zhang with Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. I have a question about your data. Were this data coming from the superficial sediment analysis, or you did include the sediments collected in buried deeper?
These are all, they would all be the top 6 inches. We use a Ponar dredge to collect our sediment samples, and we take the top 6 inches.
Okay. So what I want to point out is that when we make decisions for remediation or management decisions, somehow our decisions are not only derived from the contamination levels in surface sediment.
Right.
There are potentials, because if it is the facial sediment data, it's just a snapshot of what it is at the moment the samples were collected.
That's true.
But the bottom sediment might be stirred and expanded and become effective or available on the surface during the high flow events or whatever the nature triggered that process. So we do need to think about how the deeper sediment will be playing the role in the decision making, or maybe you could collect samples from the deeper sediments and for analysis.
I think if you went down to the deeper sediments, what you'd see is, because of the change in redox potential, the SPEMI pore mortar measurements would not be an accurate predictor at that stage, because the redox goes way down. And the organisms, this test is designed to look at what would we see where the organisms are living now. You raise a very good point, but this test is not designed to go down and look 2 feet down and be a predictor for whether or not those sediments would be toxic, because their chemistry is completely changed.
That's right. Okay, thanks.
Okay, you're welcome.
Hello, Carl Steinman with Ecology and Environment.
Okay.
I wonder if you could just briefly outline what this test entails. In broad brush strokes, and also you mentioned it's the toxicity is sensitive to the type of organic carbon that's present.
Yes.
What kinds of what were your samples predominantly, if you could characterize them?
You mean what amount of carbon was there?
Or what type of carbon? You mentioned different types of carbon.
Yeah. Well, there's two major classes. If you go to slide number 8. We talk about natural and anthropogenic meaning man influenced or man, derived by man's activities.
Right, okay.
And the fellow who actually did a lot of the chemistry on that is Upal Ghosh. And that paper that I have there on that slide is at that website. He's at the University of Maryland, Baltimore. And he goes through a number of different sites and gives ranges and everything for what we found in each site. We've gotten as high as 50-60% anthropogenic carbon at some sites, like around loading docks for coal, places like that. Generally, though, anytime you're around an industrial area, you'll get at least 10-15% anthropogenic carbon, just from man's activities in the area. And I'm sorry, what was your first question?
Just a brief outline of what this SPME test entails.
Okay.
Those of us who may not be familiar with it.
If you go to slide number 5, this test has now actually been automated by Steve Hawthorne, and there's a paper in there that cited the 2005 paper of his, which is on our website. That goes into it in detail. It's basically a type of extraction.
Okay.
Is really what he does. But that is and the big advantage we have is it's very small. We can use a very small amount, 1.5 milliliters of pore water, and get an accurate measurement. But the paper, Hawthorne et al., 2005, goes into that in great detail.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Dr. Neuhauser, we have time for one more question. If there is someone else on the phone who would like to ask a question, go ahead now. Let me take one more question from a simulcast then. This is from Susan Kane Driscoll from Exponent in Winchester, Massachusetts. Her question is, did you also analyze for BTEX or other contaminants in these samples? Could the presence of BTEX have contributed to observed toxicity in samples with less than 5 TU?
We generally, when we analyze sediment samples, we found very low BTEX. We have those numbers, I believe, for most of these samples, but we generally find, because of the situations they're in, extremely low concentrations of BTEX, unless we're actually sitting on top of a tar deposit.
Great. Thank you very much.
Okay.
We will now turn the time over to Carl Gustafson once again to introduce the next speaker. Go ahead, Carl.
Thank you, Justin. Thank you, Dr. Neuhauser, for the excellent talk and participants for the good questions. We heard a range of comments and questions from academics, folks at consulting firms and regulators from our different states, regions, and countries. So very, very interesting discussion. Our next speaker is going to be Dr. Danny Rival. He's a professor at the Department of Civil and Architectural Engineering, Architectural and Environmental Engineering at the University of Texas at Austin. Dr. Rival has been a PI on a range of different research on fundamental and applied efforts in the assessment and management of risk of hazardous substances, particularly relating to contaminated sediments, and the effectiveness of environmental remediation, including capping. He's been working on taking bioavailability assessments to the next level, applying the tools for these assessments in situ and comparing their responses to caged organisms at the sites. The title of his talk today is going to be Defining the Availability and Mobility of Contaminants and Sediments. And I want to welcome Dr. Rival and thank him for joining us.
Thank you, Carl. And appreciate the opportunity to join in on this internet seminar. And it's especially appropriate that I follow in after Ed, because we have there's a lot of links between our respective groups. I, in particular, want to point out that we'll be looking at some of the weaknesses of using bulk sediment concentration to assess exposure and risk, the usefulness of interstitial water. I'll also be trying to make that point, poor water or interstitial water, and also the usefulness of solid phase micro extraction to measure that interstitial water concentration, which is one of the most useful tools for exactly that. There are a few differences. We'll be attempting to look at in situ sampling techniques so that we don't have to generate pore water, but in fact we're trying to measure in situ, and that both brings advantages and disadvantages. But one of the advantages is we can learn a little bit more about the mechanisms of transport and through the gradients in pore water concentrations that we see, and we're trying to use that to evaluate capping, for example, as Carl alluded to, and the performance of in-situ caps, as well as just assessing the exposure and risk provided by the sediments themselves. I want to acknowledge some support for this work. I'm still on slide 20, acknowledging the support of the Department of Defense ESTCP program, which is supporting our demonstration efforts to bring solid phase microextraction to a field deployable state. Also EPA, which has supported a great deal of some of the preliminary work on the bioavailability that I've conducted, and as well some work that I'm now ongoing with NIEHS. Let's turn to slide 21 and just to emphasize the kind of the ground rules of the presentation. I'm going to be focusing on trying to relate the sediment contaminants, the concentrations that are within them, whether they're interstitial or bulk sediment, to the potential for exposure and risk. The contaminants that I'm focused on are not metals, but it will be the hydrophobic organics, both the PAHs that Ed spoke about, as well as PCBs. And I'm going to use a little different metric. I'm not going to use a threshold-like metric such as toxicity. I'm going to focus my attention on accumulation in the benthic organisms. And one of the reasons for doing that is that we have a graded response, not necessarily directly proportional response, but we don't have a yes-no answer whether it's toxic or not. And that's been more useful for some of the things that we've been trying to do. It's also especially important, of course, because benthic organisms are really a key to as a key indicator of exposure, risk, and sediments, and I think that's recognized by a lot of guidance that we now use to help regulate sediments. They certainly control or a significant factor in food chain transfer, trophic transfer of contaminants, but also their direct activities. Bioturbation are a substantial source, especially in these stable sediment environments where there's perhaps not a great deal of erosion under most conditions. They're a substantial source for flux to the overlying water. So they are key indicators as well as key players in defining exposure and risk from sediments. Well, certainly our traditional indicators, and I've turned to slide 22, is in fact bulk sediment concentration. And the primary reason for that is that it's relatively easily measured. We have the ability to measure that, and it's only been very recently that we have the ability to measure, I believe, interstitial water concentrations with the degree of detection limits and resolution that we need. But bulk sediment concentration, again, relatively easily measured. And if we look at our screening methods using sediment quality criteria, which are used in
here,
various places around the country, the primary basis of that sediment quality criteria is actually using interstitial water, but assuming equilibrium partitioning to that fork water from the bulk sediment. And for these hydrophobic organics, we generally turn to that equation that's shown there, that the fraction organic carbon and the organic carbon-based partition coefficient, the KOC, as an indicator of hydrophobicity of the compound, defines the partitioning. And so we have those screening values are often based on effects of the pore water concentration, but in the past we've had to relate that back to the bulk sediment concentration. Now the difficulty is, and I think one of the main limitations and one of the reasons that the equilibrium partitioning and the sediment quality criteria based on that is not been as effective as it might be, is that in reality the pore water concentrations are typically much less than predicted by this equation. And Ed referred to this, the black carbon that tends to absorb contaminants much more strongly, release them much to a much less extent. And as a result, as a result of this desorption resistant phenomena, we have much lower concentrations in the pore water than that relationship might suggest. And so the basic theme here is to perhaps, if we could measure the pore water concentration and not attempt to use equilibrium partitioning, then we still have the sediment quality criteria, the screening approach, but we're going to use a direct measurement rather than a equilibrium partitioning approach to get there. Well, now let me turn to bioavailability studies to show this directly, and this is work that we've done over the past 8 years, and there's been a number of groups that have looked at issues such as this, but of course I'll focus on the ones that I'm most familiar with, and that is my own. First of all, a lot of work that we've been doing is using various deposit feeding oligochaetes, or in a marine environment, a deposit feeding polychaetes. Worms, if you will, and the reason that we do that is that they're very efficient mixers of sediment. They seem to readily acclimate to the sediment. They're fairly tolerant, so we don't have toxicity issues. But again, their ability to very rapidly mix the sediment processing, the intense sediment processing that they undergo, allows you to overcome some of the mass transfer resistances that some other approaches. When we see limited bioavailability, is it because of mass transfer or is it because of inherent limitations that the organisms can't overcome? And that's one of the reasons that we use these organisms. And of course, a useful tool to relate bulk sediment concentrations to uptake and accumulation in organisms has been the biota sediment accumulation factor, which is defined as shown in this equation on slide 23. And if we think of the amount that's partitioning to tissue, which is the numerator in this equation, as partitioning with some sort of K lipid to the pore water, and the amount that's partitioning to the organic carbon in the sediment, again governed by organic carbon-based partition coefficient, then this BSAS is effectively a ratio of the partitioning to lipids to the partitioning to the organic carbon in the sediment. And it's often of order unity, but clearly there's some variations. It might be variations due to transient phenomena, or it might be due to variations associated with the chemistry of the compound. But in general, for a given sediment, if we had a good relationship between bulk sediment concentration as normalized here by organic carbon and the amount of uptake of that organic into the lipids of organisms, we'd expect that this to be a constant, probably an order one constant. If we look at some data we collected in the Anacostia River, this is actually sediment collected in the river in laboratory studies, and we compare for both pHs and TCBs on slide 24 the sediment concentration, again, normalized by organic carbon versus the uptake in the lipid of the organisms, normalized with the fraction lipid. If BFF were, in fact, a constant, we'd expect a linear plot that would slope one. It would increase with concentration. We get quite a different. We get quite a different picture. Very scattered data. No correlation, effectively, between bulk sediment concentration and the amount in the lipids based on this data. And, in fact, I don't believe the trend line, but if you were to believe the trend line, it would tell you that the best thing that we could do to reduce accumulation in the tubicissid worms in this river would be to increase the sediment concentration. But, again, I don't believe that trend line is significant, but it's certainly a far different picture than the increasing unit slope curve that we would expect if we had a sediment or if the biota sediment accumulation factor were in fact a constant. If, on the other hand, we turn to pore water concentration on slide 25, we get a very different picture and a fairly reasonable correlation, some 81% of the variance in the data described by the accumulation in the organisms based upon the predicted biota sediment accumulation factor that recognizes that, in fact, there is desorption resistance. Using the pore water concentration in the formula that's shown there, that effectively says that if the desorption resistant reduces the pore water concentration, say, by a factor of 10, then, in fact, we should see a reduction in our accumulation, the normalized accumulation, by that same factor of 10. And that's effectively what this graph is showing. And it does provide a much better correlation. It shows the best fit correlation is implying that the lipid to KOC ratio, or the amount, the partitioning to the lipids in the organisms, the organic carbon in the sediment, that the relative partition that is of the order of 1.8. That is, the lipids seem to be a little bit stronger at absorbing organics than the sediment. But the key factor there is the one that relates the desorption resistant, the direct pore water measurement. What the ratio of the KOCs is effectively, what's the ratio of what we would predict if we were using the KOC of a compound versus what we actually observe with the actual pore water concentration. Slide 26, just to kind of take that a different way and present it in a way that might be useful. We've all used bioconcentration factors for passive uptake for organisms in overlying water. That is, that there should be a correlation between the hydrophobicity of a compound and the ratio of uptake, again, by passive uptake of into the tissue from the water. And again, I'm looking at overlying water for a moment. That would be the normal use of the bioconcentration factor. And this figure is just taking that same data from the previous slides and showing that it is also useful to indicate the uptake by deposit feeders in the benthic, in the sediment, in the superficial sediments, by the benthic organisms, the benthic deposit feeders in the superficial sediments. So that despite the fact that the route of exposure is not passive uptake, and despite the fact that this is in the pore water as opposed into the overlying water, there does seem to be a very good correlation between that interstitial water concentration and uptake into the organism, and it's described by the same bioconcentration factor that we see elsewhere. Does this mean that the mechanism for uptake into these deposit-feeding organisms is from passive uptake from the pore water? No, I don't believe that's the case, but it does suggest that for these pHs and PCBs that appear on the graph, that ultimately the steady-state uptake in those organisms limited by this thermodynamic partitioning. If we turn to the next slide, slide 27, I was just illustrating that was Anacostia, but now we'd be looking at some other data. This particular set of data is a data set of sediments from New Bedford Harbor that have been sequentially diluted with freshwater sediments just to allow us to have the same sediment with a wide range of concentrations. And again, the same basic correlation comes into play. And if we continue to do that, using interstitial water concentrations and trying to use that to predict uptake in organisms on the basis of basically equilibrium partitioning from that pore water concentration, and collect all the data that we have put together from salt water and fresh water, from pHs and PCBs, from saltwater organisms and freshwater organisms, get this cumulative data set that's shown on slide 28. Certainly there's scatter in that data. A lot of that appears to be associated with the fact that the PCBs seem to accumulate to a somewhat greater extent than pHs in a normalized sense. That is, perhaps you could think of it as the K lipid over the organic carbon-based partition coefficient is somewhat higher for the PCBs than the pHs. Also, we see a trend, and I wouldn't say that we have enough data to say whether will be observed consistently or not, is that in general the saltwater organisms and saltwater sediments seem to show somewhat greater accumulation than the freshwater system. But certainly if we did a correlation such as this with a particular sediment, particular site, we could get the very low variability that was shown in some of the preceding slides. But even if I put everything together here, at least I get from all different kinds of sites and different conditions and different organisms, all deposit feeding, we're still getting a correlation which is much stronger than the bulk sediment concentration. If I turn to slide 29, I think that leads me to this conceptual model, is that we have these, first of all, in the sediment itself, we have strongly sorptive sediment phases that cause desorption resistance and therefore decrease the pore water concentration over what we would expect from reversible linear partitioning based upon KOC-FOC type relationships. That's certainly well recognized. As a result of the fact that this desorption in sediments, because those sediments are in a very slow transport processes that might purge that pore water, we tend to reach an equilibrium or an apparent equilibrium. I'm not necessarily saying that the pore water is always in thermodynamic equilibrium with the sediments. And in fact, the very fact that you've got this much different from what we predict by KOC-FOC suggests that it is an apparent equilibrium. But because it's not being turned over very rapidly, we tend to see a fairly stable pore water concentration. If we were to purge it completely, I fully expect that we could continue to pull contaminants off that sediment. So it's not like we have a fraction that is available, but we do have a limited availability because of that pore water concentration is relatively stable in achieving an apparent equilibrium. And that those deposit feeding organisms, by the data that we've shown in the preceding slides, I believe achieve an apparent equilibrium, a thermodynamic equilibrium between the pore water and those organisms that seems to be, again, well indicated and well described by traditional partitioning relationships from the pore water concentration measurements. We turn to slide 30. The difficulty with that is that, and traditionally the problem has been, and I certainly believe there's other literature as well that from a variety of researchers that in fact show this, that the interstitial water is a good indication, and it is identified and recognized, for example, in EPA guidance as well, that the interstitial water is a good indication for exactly these reasons. The problem has always been, how do we measure that? And that's where both Ed and I have turned to solid phase microextraction. For those of you who don't know much about solid phase microextraction, we're looking at essentially a fiber optic cable, 100, 200 microns in diameter typically, with a thin coating of a very sorbent polymer. So we can think of this as effectively we're putting in a particle of sorbent sediment into our sediment system. It's equilibrating with the pore water. It's small enough that it's not actually depleting substantially the concentration in the water. We're not changing dramatically the concentration in the water, the non-depletive measurement. But it is equilibrating with that. And then we're pulling that soil particle or sediment particle effectively back out and measuring the contaminant that has been absorbed on it. And so we have the accuracy and resolution of a solid phase measurement, but what it's actually measuring is its equilibration with that interstitial water. we're looking at, again, a very small amount of material, but we can achieve very low detection limits. And our approach on slide 31 is to try to field deploy that material. Now, it's a very fragile fiber, but we built this very simple sheath system that's shown on slide 31 with a slotted tube. It looks like we're just allowing the slots to allow water to pass back and forth onto this fiber. And so when we insert this into the sediment, it becomes equilibrated over time with the pore water that's adjacent to it in the sediment. And then we can remove it at some later time and chop it up and analyze it. On the bottom left of the slide on page 30, or on number 31, you can see the detection limits for even a centimeter length. We're looking at detection limits that are down in the 1 nanogram per liter range and below, typically. And as a result, and the more hydrophobic, the more sorbent a compound is, the lower the detection limits. So it fits in quite well with what actually is observed in the pore water, namely the more hydrophobic will have lower concentrations. And these detection limits are measured from a single centimeter of this fiber. So if we inserted, say, 30 centimeters deep into a sediment, allowed it to equilibrate with the pore water, remove that fiber, and then chop it up into 1 centimeter lengths, in each of those centimeters we have a pore water concentration that we can detect that's at these levels, and we get a profile with that degree of resolution, should we desire it. If we were only interested in what organisms are exposed to in the upper, say, 5 to 10 centimeters, we could take that entire 5 to 10 centimeters, analyze that, and get even lower detection limits, but also get a good average pore water concentration. Slide 32, one of the issues here, if we're going to place this somewhat like a peeper system, for those of you who've used peepers, this is how we would do that, and this is the negative side of deploying it in the field, in situ, is that we have to wait for equilibrium. Ed's approach is to pull that sediment, generate some pore water, and then measure concentration in that pore water, which is a relatively quick process. It's certainly slower if we do it in situ and more complicated, but I'll show you some of the advantages a little bit later. We can see that the kinetics for some of the lighter pHs are really quite fast. So we would not have to leave the sampling rods in place for very long for pHs. We will be deploying, beginning next week actually, at a site in San Diego in cooperation with another project, where we're going to remove these rods 2 days after placement and see if we can in fact demonstrate this in the field, that that we have some useful information. That will also be compared directly to bioassay measurements that are ongoing at the same time, so we'll get directly a comparison at that site. And I'll show you some others where we've done that before. Illustrating, perhaps surprisingly, is not a strong effect of temperature on kinetics, which is advantageous so that we don't have to worry about cold water versus hot water issues. And then on slide 34, however, I show PCBs, and the PCB uptake kinetics appear to be considerably slower. And this is a problem that we're dealing with. Perhaps the best way to manage this is through choice of the fiber that we employ, maximizing effectively surface area to volume ratio, and that if we're able to do that, we can improve the kinetics pretty dramatically. On slide 35, just to repeat what I've mentioned is how do we deploy these. I would say more typically, because especially if we're interested in the PCBs, we've been trying with our current fibers using 10 to 30 day deployments, mostly along the upper end of that, which is the same sort of period that we've often placed peepers in the past, so it hasn't been a problem for us. We deploy with divers. They can be deployed from the surface without divers, but it's possible, it's easiest in our application so far to have used divers to deploy and retrieve. Again, it is in situ, so we don't have to worry about removing the sediment or compromising the pore water integrity as a result of removing that sediment. And that is useful when we need to retain the gradients that we would see in the field. We could also remove sediment for example, in box cores, and then do the same thing in the lab where we certainly don't have to use divers, don't have to, and still retain in a box core a lot of that information on gradients, et cetera. But once we remove it from the sediments, whether we do it in situ or ex situ, we then section the fiber to whatever desired resolution that we need. We would extract, and there's a couple of ways of doing that, but we try to extract with as minimum dilution as possible. It's we're quite easy. It's as simple as mixing with a little bit of solvent that we would then directly inject into our analysis system, depending on what compounds we're looking at. Page 36 shows you one of the data sets. Again, this is Anacostia River, where we've done an awful lot of the development work here, illustrating why I do believe it is a very useful tool for in situ assessment of pore water concentrations. If we look at bulk sediment concentrations in this area of the Anacostia, there's very little variability. Between the near surface and a foot down, we're looking at, certainly I've never seen more than a factor of two in any of our sediment samples. It's a very homogeneous sediment, very uniform bulk sediment concentrations. And yet, when we look at this field-deployed fiber, here looking at two just to see if there was any problems in sample integrity, one that was cut in the field while we were there, separated into sections and examining the profile, and the other brought back to the lab, both quite consistent and showing a change in concentration from in excess of 1 microgram per liter pyrene in pore water a foot into the sediment, 30 centimeters, and effectively zero or an order of magnitude, 1 to 2 orders of magnitude, and the near surface sediment. So the gradient is quite large. I have to believe this has an enormous impact on an organism that is interacting with 0 to 5 centimeters of sediment as opposed to 0 to 10 centimeters of sediment, for example. Certainly, I think it is an important indicator. I can't help you decide how to use this directly at this time, but I think that we're going to try to continue to push to see what the implications are. And one of the ways we do that is through caged organisms that are placed simultaneously with this rod so that we can look at accumulation in those organisms at the same time and perhaps other biological endpoints as well and try to relate that to what we're seeing here. Certainly based on the lab work, we would expect to see an equilibration of the near-surface sediment pore water concentrations with organism uptake. And on slide 37, showing just a preliminary effort to do that, in this case, a Lumbriculus variegatus in caged organisms in the field. This was our first deployment last summer of the two simultaneously caged organisms as well as this profiling system. And what we have here is looking at the integrated average concentration in the pore water as measured by SPME, using that to estimate tissue concentrations in these organisms. And there's a lot of scatter in this at this stage, but still a hint of a correlation, and we're hoping as we control factors better that we can show in the field just as good a correlations as we get with pore water in the lab. I'd also like to spend the last few minutes of my time, and I'm moving on to slide 39, to examine another application of this, again, to illustrate the usefulness of the interstitial water concentrations, but also to address a problem of exposure and risk that I believe is of importance to many of you. And that is the thin layer capping that we often apply after placement of, or after a dredging implementation, where we have residuals left at the surface of the sediment. And commonly, a sand layer, perhaps 4 to 6 inches thick, might be placed, perhaps somewhat thicker, might be placed after that in an effort to reduce the availability of the contaminants that are present in that superficial residual layer and to help improve the recovery of the system. And so we're trying to explore that in the laboratory and illustrate at the same time the use of the solid phase microextraction fibers to be able to demonstrate that. And so we have organisms that are being that are populating this thin layer sand layer over contaminated sediments, and we're looking at both pore water concentration profiles and uptake into these organisms. And we're using various thicknesses of layers and various thickness or various time periods of exposure. In each of these cases, because these deposit feeders will not go to clean sand, and at least if they can avoid it, they are deposit feeders. They need organic matter to feed and to live comfortably. And so we're also, in each of these, simulated that deposition of new clean sediment, in this case just a half centimeter thick layer of new sediment, fine-grained sediment, which is clean and devoid of contaminants, has been placed on top of that sand. So we have a situation where there's been dredging, there's a residual on the surface, thin layer capping has been placed by a sand layer, and then over time, perhaps in an additional year, there's been some redeposition or new deposition of clean material to the top of a thin layer of half a centimeter. That's the way these experiments were done. And the questions are, can that thin layer sand cap reduce bioaccumulation in the organisms, and can the pore water concentrations indicate that? 39 is just showing what we call a T-cell that we use for a lot of these experiments to simulate cap-like environments and sediment water interface type environments. Slide 40 is showing pore water concentrations measured by the solid phase microextraction, showing that in fact you get high resolution. We're looking at changes in concentration with depth in this thin layer capped area, and looking at various depths of cap, a no cap, a 2 centimeter cap, a 4 centimeter cap, and a 6 centimeter cap. As you can see, the 0, 2, and 4 centimeter thin layer cap, there's almost no difference between them in pore water concentrations. And the 6 centimeter cap, however, there is a substantial difference in the pore water concentrations, that in fact there is a depletion. If we were to look at, say, 4 centimeters in depth, we have a concentration that is perhaps 10 to 20% of what it is at 4 centimeters into those thinner layer capped environments. And so, and again, each of these are populated with organisms because that was our goal here. And so what the organisms have done is that in the 0, 2, and 4 centimeter thin layer cap, they've compromised the cap, they've extended into the underlying sediment and brought contaminants up, whereas in the 6 centimeter cap, that has not been the case. Slide 41 is just showing the resulting bioaccumulation. And indeed, the very, very thin layer cap for the organisms that might extend down, these organisms' maximum length is about 4 centimeters. Their tails are usually at the near surface because they still have to have oxygen to breathe, if you will. And as a result, when they can extend down into that through the cap layer, they essentially achieve a accumulation of the underlying sediment. But when it's a thicker layer, even 6 and 10 centimeters, that's not the case. They do absorb significantly less, perhaps due to occasional excursions below that or to light transport up. Now keep in mind this is with diffusion only, and based on our pore water paradigm, if we actually had upwelling by groundwater, I would expect to see much closer agreement between all of these, namely even the 6 and 10 centimeter thick cap would be compromised because of the fact that the pore water would look more and more like the underlying sediment. And this again is on slide 42 is just illustrating once again that the interstitial water concentrations do provide a good correlation and a direct indication of the accumulation in the organisms. This is the same correlation. I apologize, it's slightly different here. If I took the pore water concentration instead of having it on the x-axis, put it on the y-axis, this is effectively bioconcentration factor versus octanol water partition coefficient again. And again, we get excellent agreement with a parity line, a one-to-one slope being a very good fit with very little variability. And this is on a linear scale, of course, not even a log scale. So the pore water is a good indication, and the thin layer cap allows the separation of that pore water from the organisms and allows reduction in the accumulation in those organisms. So on slide 43, let me finish by just emphasizing that I tried to indicate that I do believe that interstitial water concentration is a useful metric for identifying accumulation of these hydrophobic organics into these organisms, and that accumulation is reduced over what you might expect from the equilibrium partitioning approach, primarily due to this desorption resistance. And that desorption resistance is hard to predict. It depends on whether some of those materials that Ed pointed out, what fraction of the organic carbon is associated with those types of materials, what types of materials are they. But the fact that we can measure directly the pore water concentration allows us to measure directly what the impact of that desorption resistance is, and again, use that as an indication of uptake into the organism. That has been the use of the measurement of the pore water, I think, has allowed us for both pHs and PCBs to relate uptake. And this is, I should emphasize, one of the reasons we use these deposit feeders that are processing sediment intensely. We're looking at steady state accumulation. It also is indicating that despite the fact that the uptake is through ingestion, especially for the more hydrophobic compounds, still this pore water has been a useful indicator. And so the bioconcentration factor has been as useful, I believe, to me, based on this data, that is useful for in-situ exposure to these deposit-feeding organisms as it has been for passive uptake in organisms in overlying water. And, of course, the basis of all this is the solid-phase microextraction, without which or without a similar technique, we just would not be able to measure that interstitial water concentration. Well, thank you for your attention. Let me open it up to questions.
We'll first take questions from the phone lines. If you have a question, please take your phone off mute, state your name and organization, and go ahead and ask your question.
This is Brett Thomas with EPA Region 4. I had a quick question, if I could, for Danny. If when the SPME comes to equilibrium, or you said that the SPME is not, it's not sampling the water in the traditional sense of thinking of it's sucking all of the contaminant out of the water onto the SPME, and you pull the SPME out. You said it's more coming into equilibrium with the pore water?
That's correct.
Without really depleting the concentrations. But then I was just trying to think conceptually. You've got contaminant desorbing off of the sediment into the pore water, and you figure that the more water soluble the contaminant is, you know, the lower the KOW of that contaminant, the more of it would be represented, I guess, in the pore water. But then when you're putting the SPME in, it's like it's almost a converse thing, in that the higher the KOW, the tighter it would, you know, the more of it would partition to the SPME. So you'd have the lower KOW stuff would be higher concentrations of that in the pore water than the high KOW stuff. But on your SPME, it would almost be the reverse. The higher KOW stuff would soar more vehemently to the SPME. You see what I'm saying?
Correct.
Is that... Go ahead.
And in fact, if you remember back on slide 31, it's showing exactly that the less hydrophobic compounds, which are the left side of this graph, are going to have higher detection limits. It's much harder to determine BTEX, for example, compounds, than it is these very hydrophobic compounds. And, of course, they may be present at much higher concentrations, so it may not even be needed. But it is true that the more soluble the compound, the less of the advantage that you get from using a SPME type of analysis, the solid-phase microextraction analysis.
All right, so then does that limited ability to, as you say, kind of accurately predict what's in the pore water as opposed to kind of somehow get a pore water sample and then, you know, liquid extracting or something like that, solid-phase extracting your cartridge and then injecting it, you know what I mean?
Yes, but what you're, the big advantage that you have with this small fiber is that even though it is a strong sorbent for these heavy hydrophobics, it is, we have such a small amount of it that it is not substantially depleting the pore water. That is, it's not taking a great deal of mass out of the system. And as a result, it's, we're not disrupting the equilibrium in the sediment. Again, it's considered a non-depletive measurement. But what we are doing is we're concentrating that into a very small volume that we can manage directly without extraction, or excuse me, without a large volume extraction of pore water to get something that we can inject and analyze in a GC or in a HPLC.
Sure.
So it's just concentration in a very small volume, and if we maintain that through our analysis approach, for example, one way of extracting the contaminants back off of this is a complete splitless injection using thermal desorption, where 100% of the mass, that very small amount of mass that's on the steam, it goes directly on, into and onto column. And so again, you can achieve very low detection limits without absorbing, having such a sorbent in there that you've significantly disrupted the equilibrium.
Thank you.
You can stay with the phone lines. If you have a question, please take your phone off mute, state your name and organization, and ask your question.
This is Chuck Maurice in Region 5, and I just wanted to follow up on the previous question, which I thought was an excellent question.
Can you speak up a bit?
Chuck, yeah, go ahead. Speak up a little bit, Chuck. Thank you.
Okay. I want to follow up on the previous question because I thought that was an excellent question. And it got me to thinking about does the SPEMI then, even though you're not disrupting the equilibrium in the pore water itself, aren't you getting a distorted distribution? Because there's only so many available sites on a SPEMI for the binding to take place. Aren't you getting due to preferential binding, aren't you getting a distortion of the distribution of contaminants?
Well, I don't believe that's the case, because it is an absorption phenomena, and so some of the issues that are more relevant often with an adsorptive phenomena, like competitive adsorption, and especially at these low concentrations, I don't believe we're seeing much of a variation. Now, where you can see a distortion is when you don't achieve equilibrium, because clearly the lower molecular weight, faster absorbing compounds are going to, if we do a two-day study, for example, we're going to see more of those compounds than we see in the more hydrophobics. So if we don't achieve equilibrium, then that would certainly be the case. Now, much of what we're doing is we're comparing directly the accumulation of compound A with the onto the SPEMI with accumulation of that same compound onto organism. And so for that sort of a comparison, that distribution wouldn't even come up. But again, if we allow it a sufficient time to achieve equilibrium, or if we know enough about the kinetics that we can extrapolate from what we have measured to equilibrium, I don't believe that we're getting the distorted mix of compounds on the SPEMI.
Okay, and that's just following your logic. Correct me if I'm wrong. So what you believe your results are showing a better correlation with what the organism is picking up than your purpose is not to measure the relative concentrations and distribution of concentrations in the pore water is what's being taken up, and the SPEMI is mimicking that. Is that correct?
Well, certainly our goal is to use this as an indicator of what's accumulating in the organism.
Yeah.
But I would also say that if allowed to achieve to equilibrium or corrected for equilibrium, I believe it also indicates the absolute pore water concentration in that pore water. That, again, absolute pore water concentration. We've tried to show that as best we can by taking more traditional measurements. For example, trying to extract volumes of pore water and then do an extraction followed by analysis. And as best we can detect, we get the same concentrations. Admittedly, it's much more difficult to measure concentrations by those conventional methods, for example, by centrifugation and generating pore water and extracting it. So I suppose we haven't done as many of those as we'd like, but what we have done so far would suggest to us that we are able to get, with the solid phase microextraction, a true measurement of that pore water concentration.
Okay, thank you.
Danny, I had a question. This is Carl Gustafson, Army RDC. You know, you showed that graph that showed tremendous variability in pH uptake in the vertical plane in the SDMEs that you had vertically. What's your experience with what you see horizontally? Do you see large variations in bioavailability and pore water concentration across the site? And to sort of take that a step further, are you able to use those tools to identify areas, for instance, groundwater, upwelling, and would your STEMI profiler be able to detect something like that?
I believe it would. We're talking specifically for those on the at the seminar on slide 36. And so this gradient near surface, I would say that it is not repeated horizontally in this particular area. Again, the Anacostia River is a relatively uniform concentrations. It's a relatively homogeneous near-surface sediment environment. Near shore and in certain portions of the site, there is groundwater upwelling, which would influence this picture, presumably. But I think what we're seeing here is largely a reflection of pore water pumping or tidal pumping of the pore water. As tides go up and down, the near-surface environment is getting flushed more effectively, and so the biologically active zone is seeing relatively low pore water concentrations. And I think that's really what we're seeing here. Faster depletion as a result of that than can be fed from below. And that's where it could be useful for mechanistic information. But again, if we go horizontally, we don't see that these same variations. Certainly in certain portions of the site, we could see higher concentrations rather than lower, but still, we don't see these sort of gradients in near this extreme at this particular site. But it could be used to, again, look at mechanisms if we saw a completely different profile over an area where we had active upwelling and seeps. I would expect to see a profile that didn't look like this, but would in fact be a much higher concentration faster as you move down in depth. That is a more of an inverted L, I guess would be the best way to describe it, is what I would see if we had lots of groundwater upwelling. Whereas here, this looks like a diffusion-like profile, and I think that's reflective of this tidal pumping.
Thank you.
We will take a simulcast question now. This is another question from Mary Logan, U.S. EPA Region 5 in Chicago. This is a multi-part question. She asks, for the field test of STEMIs, how important might local area variations be in designing the development of the field-placed STEMIs? And do you have any cost information? And are you able to translate the field STEMI results to recommended outcomes?
Okay, taking the first, I think we do suffer from any of these near-point measurements. We suffer from the same problem, is that how do we ensure that we have enough samples to get representative indications of what our concentrations, whether they're pore water or bulk sediment concentrations. And this is very much a point measurement. We're looking at a quarter-inch diameter rod, which makes it very easy to insert in and out. But we're averaging over a very, very small distance and vertically the same way. It is not that different from a point core problem. Might be a little bit larger area, but compared to the size of our site, it's still very, very small. So all that we can do relative to that is take enough samples so that we understand what that variability is across the site and decide whether that can be important to us or not. The second question was cost, and the cost of the fibers, which is the only significant, well, I guess there are multiple costs here. The first of all, the cost of deployment and retrieval are effectively the same cost that you would have with a typical coring operation. Namely, the bulk of the cost is associated with personnel and putting a boat out there. The cost of the incremental cost associated with the sampling here is the cost of the fiber itself. But the cost of the fiber can be relatively small. I would say that you can buy these fibers in bulk from manufacturers, and I'm talking about several hundred meters at a time, that can be adapted and used for this purpose. We are in the process in our demonstration project to try to ensure that a laboratory would be able to fully use this option to basically try to set it up such that a lab, instead of send you sampling vials, would send you a rod with this fiber already loaded. You'd insert it, pull it out, and then send it back to that same lab. And then again, additional cost to that, I really believe, is quite minimal compared to the analysis itself. Again, for several hundred meters of this fiber, if we buy it in bulk, can be just a few hundred dollars. Finally, the cost of analysis is a relatively simple analysis. There is a simple one-step extraction. There may be a cleanup step, but the analysis costs certainly are no more than they would be for an equivalent sediment sample, and far less than if you were trying to take a sediment sample, centrifuge it, generate pore water, and handle that. Requires no more complex handling than a bulk sediment sample once it goes to the lab. And then finally, could you repeat the third comment? I wrote a note to myself, sealed, and I'm not sure that I needed to write a longer note to myself.
Sure. The third part was, are you able to translate the field steaming results into recommended outcomes?
Yes. And this is where I think the use of the sediment quality criteria and the equilibrium partition approach, I think that's, you know, ultimately that has been discredited a great deal. A lot of people dislike the approach, but I think the real failing of the approach is because it didn't take into account desorption resistance and limited availability, whereas this measure does. And so by translating the concentrations that we measure in pore water directly into toxic units, as was done by Ed, or other indicators of concentrations that are considered acceptable or unacceptable, again, whether it's toxicity or some other endpoint. Those same indicators could be applied here, but using, again, measured pore water concentration rather than predicted ones like an equilibrium partitioning approach. It is also true that you could, in a relative sense, if you're interested in trying to relate where are more contaminated areas rather than less contaminated areas, the fiber concentration itself, rather without even conversion to a pore water concentration, has been and could be used as a indicator of uptake into organisms or an indicator of exposure.
Thank you. I think we have time for about one more question before we enter the question and answer period for either presenter. Is there anyone on the phone that would like to answer a question? Hey, we have one more from...
Another question from Region 5.
Okay, go ahead.
Was this SPME method applied at any of the sites that Dr. Neuhauser referred to, where he did some of his studies using his method?
As of this time, we have not gone to any of the MGP sites with this technique. We are in the process of doing that with, have a project with EPRI where we're going to be demonstrating a capping approach on the Hudson River where we will in fact employ this. And we will have also, we also expect to be employing this in a similar sort of a creosote site, not a too dissimilar chemical mix, in Portland, Oregon later this summer. And then finally, I would say that we do have one common intersection point, if you will. Both of us have, that is both Ed's group and our group, have managed or done this evaluation, are both separate evaluations in a sediment at Hunter's Point. But as far as I know, that's the only point of intersection at this stage, Hunter's Point, California. And I'm not sure that that was in, even in the set of data that Ed presented because it was, it's not a MGP site and it's not a pH contamination. So I don't think it was in Ed's slide. But as far as I know, that that is our only point of intersection.
Well, the reason that I ask the question is how would you anticipate the results to possibly be different between this SPME method and the previous method that Dr. Neuhauser was talking about?
I don't, I do not believe that the interstitial water concentrations that would be measured would be different. There is a potential when you remove the sediment, some loss during handling, that could be a cause of concern. There's also the advantage of our in situ method in that if we're looking at profiles where we can determine some mechanism information, for example, mechanism of transport for a conceptual model development, that's an advantage of our method. The disadvantage, of course, is that it's more intensive to go out and, for example, use divers to place in the field than it is to collect a sediment sample and then process it completely in the lab. So there's advantages and disadvantages both ways. I fully expect that there should be no substantial differences in the actual concentration that is measured by either method.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Reibel. Before we open up questions and answer sessions to both presenters, I wanted to make sure everyone was aware of the last two slides of the presentation. The second to last slide contains links to the SBRP Risk E-Learning page, where you will find links to archives of this and the previous Risk E-Learning seminars. The last slide contains links to the additional resources page, where we have assembled resources that are directly applicable to today's topic. This will stay with the seminar indefinitely so you can access it after the presentation. Associated with the links page is an online feedback form. We ask that you consider filling out the online feedback form. We do look at your comments as we continue to try to improve the content and delivery mechanism. Links to the additional resources page and the feedback form can be found on the last slide of the presentation. I will now open the question and answer session to either presenter. If you have a question, please take your phone off mute, state your name and organization, and ask your question.
Excuse me just a second. Let me ask a question. I believe that I've been traveling so much I hadn't gotten you some additional resources. If I were to send you something in the next day or two, you could also put it up there as well?
That's correct. If you can send that to me whenever, and we can just go ahead and put that on there.
Well, I have a report that probably summarizes best the detection limit kinetics, the way that you would employ this, and I'll post that to you.
Great. Thank you.
This is Steve Glazer with SLG Consulting, and I'm wondering if you just went out and measured KOCs of your individual sediments, do you think you'd get the majority of the benefit that you get from these FPME measurements?
If we're measuring KOC, are we talking about an effective KOC? Or are we, KOC is a compound quantity if we're talking about a tabulated function. If we take the sediment concentration divided by a fraction organic, a pore water, well, anyway, what do you mean by your KOC?
I guess what I'm thinking is if you were to, well, maybe you just pointed out a problem with what I'm getting at here. I was thinking if you just, in effect, measure, if you took the overall sediment itself and you measured the organic content, if you did a measurement of your organic compound, I'm not speaking very well. If you measured your fraction of organic matter and then perhaps add water to the system and measure your concentration within that water in a bulk system, would you get much of the same benefit?
I think you could, because there are, people have attempted to measure a water that would be in equilibrium with a sediment. Certainly, there's no standardized process of which I'm aware that people are comfortable with that would define the volume sediment, volume water, where you get consistent results. Being able to directly measure pore water, either in situ or ex situ, I think would be considered preferable to that. And if you were, I don't think what you've described is any more complicated than being able to generate a small pore water sample such that Ed's approach would employ. And so I don't see a particular reason, an advantage to doing it that way. You could just as easily do the extraction of a small volume of pore water, which you could do fairly easily as per Ed's approach.
Okay, thank you.
You can stay with the phone line. If you have a question, go ahead and take your phone off mute, state your name, organization, and ask your question.
Yeah, this is Carl Gustafson again, Army ERDC. This is for Dr. Neuhauser. In Dr. Ivel's presentation, he talked about the desorption-resistant phase, and you also talked about how various phases of organic carbon can modify the effects of the toxicity that you're seeing in your assays. I'm wondering how easy it is to operationalize these findings. If you're going to, if the field's moving in the direction that this is really a big deal and that organic carbon is an organic carbon, is it easy enough to take these assays and include them and be able to, in site characterization and be able to, replicate them across sites and, have this be part of sort of a standard analysis, when you're thinking about bioavailability and effects?
Yes, that's actually what we want to do, is have this as part of a normal assessment of a site, something you would do routinely.
And can you just touch base briefly on what type of assays that involve and what the results are?
I guess I'm missing your question. What do you mean when you say what kinds of assays, Carl?
Well, I'm thinking about as we're defining various types of organic carbon, whether it be lignite or anthracite or anthropogenic or biologically derived carbon. I mean, what do you end up getting? Is it a list of 12 different types of carbon and your percentages of those, or how do you actually end up, or what do your results look like? And I'm trying to understand whether it's something that can be interpretable and be used at a range of sites.
Well, first of all, I'd send you back to Upal Ghosh's paper.
Yeah.
He really goes into that in great detail. But in reality, what we see is the SPEME test actually is a way of interpreting what all those different kinds of carbon are actually doing.
And Carl, I would, this is Danny again, I would suggest the same, is that I think both Ed and I have proposed that instead of doing that, which is certainly possible and people have suggested as a research effort, I try to evaluate that, and there's a number of people that have worked on the different carbon and what their relative desorption resistance might be. But I think Ed and I are both suggesting is that for practical use, let's just measure the impact of all that by measuring the pore water.
Right, good point.
You can stay with the phone line. If you have a question, go ahead and take your phone off mute, state your name, organization, and ask your question.
Greg Dukowski with the State of Delaware. With all these different types of organic carbon, and do we need to be taking samples for microscope analysis to see what kind of carbon we've got before we can use the results?
This is Ed. I don't think you really need to do that because, as we pointed out in the previous question, you're interpreting what that carbon is doing by the measurements that you're getting through the SPEME testing.
But how does that correlate to the behavior of the contaminants in the organism? I mean, does one type of carbon more closely correlate with what a living organism is doing than another?
Well, I think what's happening is that all of those carbons are acting together, and they'll give you an end result of a concentration that's available to the organism. So I don't think to the organism the type of carbon makes any difference. It's what the organism sees after the interaction of the chemical and the carbon that's important.
Okay, thank you.
This is Steve Klau with Haley and Aldrich with a question for Dr. Reibel. Your research suggests that using a sand cap really wouldn't be effective, and that to really be effective, you have some type of matrix with a normal or greater than normal organic carbon content in it?
Actually, I wouldn't characterize it that way. There were two objectives, the reason I included those set of slides at the end of my talk. One was to show that the interstitial water concentration correlated well with the uptake in the organism, which is our primary goal of the discussion today. And then secondly, though, I think it does show that even a thin sand cap layer, as long as it's thin enough to separate organisms from the actual contaminated sediment, can be quite effective. The question was largely is, can even a thin non-sorbing sand cap be an effective residual containment measure? And I would suggest that our data indicates that it can be, although I would also caution that if we had an area where there was significant upwelling, where that groundwater would be penetrating up into that surface layer and this non-sorbing sand cap, that it may not be. Just as in a full-fledged capping system, if there's a lot of groundwater upwelling, a lot of flow up, and I'm talking about it greater than multiple centimeters per day or centimeter per day is usually a kind of an indication of when we've got some significant upwelling. In those sort of situations, a conventional sand cap may not be effective, regardless of how thick it might be. But again, in this case, as long as the thickness of the cap layer was large enough that the organisms were not directly interacting with the underlying sediment, it was sufficient to again, in this case, without upwelling, it was sufficient to significantly reduce accumulation in the organisms at the surface.
But in order to have the organisms survive, I mean, plain sand really isn't very productive, right?
No, but in general, just as we did in our lab experiments, there is you would often have some deposition of new fine-grained material over time,
right,
at the surface, and you know, for example, in our Anacostia active cap demonstration project that began 3 years ago, within a year we had sediment on top and we had repopulation with benthic organisms. And, of course, the downside of that is since it was just a demonstration project that the sediment that was settling on top was contaminated. But assuming that we've managed sources, that new sediment, after we've done a remediation, hopefully will be clean sediment, and organisms will repopulate as soon as they have food.
Oh, okay, thank you. Excellent work.
We can go to the simulcast now for a question. This question is from Susan Kane Driscoll with Exponent in Winchester, Massachusetts. This is a two-part question. She says, I understand that Dr. Reibel's approach is non-depletive. Is Dr. Neuhauser's approach depletive? What are the advantages, disadvantages of depletive versus non-depletive approaches?
Danny, do you understand what she means by a depletive approach?
Yes, I can answer that if you'd like. Ed's approach is to actually take a pool water sample and then analyze that in the lab. Yes, it is an effort to be depletive. I don't believe there's inherent advantages or disadvantages. In that case, since you've already separated the sediment from the water, you could deplete. You do get better detection limits, which would be an advantage, because you can place enough fiber to absorb effectively all of the contaminant or a large fraction of the contaminant that's in the small sampling vial. So you can get better detection limits is primarily the difference. And the sediment, our detection limits are, for example, let me just choose a single compound with a given fiber. We're looking at of the order of a nanogram per liter for something of the hydrophobicity of pyrene for a centimeter length of fiber. I believe that Ed's approach, you could go further than that with your 1 milliliter water sample. So again, I think that's the primary advantage.
Thank you. We can go back to the phone lines if there's any questions. Go ahead and take your phone off mute. State your name.
Did you say there was a second part to Susan's question?
Let's see. Yes, there was the second part. Hold on 1 second. I think he covered that too. That was one of the advantages and disadvantages of depletive versus non-depletive approaches.
Okay, got it.
Okay, we'll take another quick question from Simulcast. This question is from Hui Min Yang from the West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection. The question is, two-part also, the kinetics of uptake PCBs and PAHs are different, the slides 34 versus slide 32. Any thoughts on that? And the second part of the question is there any information about dioxins?
Okay. The kinetics are different. We don't understand the mechanism of that. There have been some other approaches, for example, using polyethylene that seems to show similar behavior, that the PCBs can be considerably lower in that matrix as well. At this stage, it is an observation that it influences the way that we manage the samples, but I can't extrapolate or give a good reason why. But we can certainly measure what that kinetics is and plan our sampling plans accordingly. We have not done any work with dioxins. I do believe that the uptake onto the fibers as a hydrophobic, since it's governed primarily by hydrophobic interactions, would be quite similar. But again, I can't say, since we haven't done the work, what that kinetics would be.
So we have time for one more question, and then we will have to conclude. If you have additional questions, you can contact Dr. Neuhauser and Dr. Reibel via their email. You can go to the phone lines. If there's anyone on the phone who has a question, please take your phone off mute, state your name, organization, and go ahead and ask your question. Okay, I think that probably concludes the phone questions. We've got one more for the simulcast speakers. This is for Dr. Neuhauser. He says, in slide 8, are there any conditions where anthropogenic carbon will release PAHs?
No, we haven't seen that happen at all. They're generally much tighter binding to PAHs than natural organic carbon. And it's because there's many more aromatic rings in the anthropogenic than there is in the natural. That's what changes the characteristic of the carbon.
Okay, I think that answers all the questions. I would like to thank our moderator, Carl Gustafson, the Contaminated Sediment Liaison to US EPA, US Army Engineer Research and Development Center, and our presenters, Dr. Edward Neuhauser, Principal Environmental Engineer, National Grid, and Dr. Danny Reibel, Professor, Department of Civil, Architectural, and Environmental Engineering, University of Texas at Austin. That concludes today's presentation. Thank you for your participation.
Okay.